The controversy amps up at JEA. Duval County Schools may hire dozens of new school safety officers. And what do you think of those new Jaguars uniforms? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, by popular demand, they're back again as we spend most of the hour this morning with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line now and join us at 549-2937 as we talk about all the biggest stories of the week. Then later, he's one of the most famous, timeless, popular singers in music history. A conversation with the great Johnny Mathis later on as he plays the Florida Theater. That's all ahead, but first it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Hey,
Dan.
Good
morning. Good morning.
Claire Gofort, the editor of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
John McGowan, columnist at the Beaches Leader.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT business editor, John Burr.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you all here, guys, and so much to talk about this week. Everything from those new Jaguars uniforms. Did you see those? Did you also check out the renderings of the new proposed entertainment district around Everbank Field? We'll talk about that. Also, possible new school safety officers in the local public schools. All of that ahead. But our top story right now, the hits just keep on coming at JEA. The week started with the controversial hiring by the JEA board of their fellow board member, Aaron Zahn, as interim CEO. Zahn had only been on the board since January. This after rejecting inside candidate, the CFO of the company, Melissa Dykes, who had far more experience at the utility. The following day, Mayor Lenny Curry held a press conference with Zahn, where it was revealed that former Jacksonville Mayor Jake Godbold delivered a personal letter to Curry telling him that the controversy over JEA and its potential sale has damaged his credibility. Godbold added, quoting here, "Despite your frequent statements that you've not made up your mind on the JEA's future, I am one of a whole lot of people in Jacksonville who's having a hard time believing you." Godbold also spoke with our news partner WJXT and anchor Tom Wills, and he said the letter was just a little friendly advice to Mayor Curry. Oh, we don't actually have that cut. But since then, Curry has said he has spoken with Godbold and they will set up a meeting to talk. Now, add to all of this a city council committee meeting where council members warn new CEO Zahn to tread lightly. And Jaguars owner Shad Khan this week came out strongly against a possible sale of JEA. He said he thought it would be a terrible idea. This is the story that has everyone talking. We're going to talk about it right now. What are your thoughts about all the latest news around JEA? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we also welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. Everything from Jake Godbold to Shad Khan now weighing in on this matter.
Well, Shad Khan's exact words were, "It is a terrible idea," quote, as we reported in the TU. "I've seen this all over the country. When you have something of really a public entity like that getting privatized, it doesn't work well for the residents." He's not in favor of it. Jake Godbold, who was, I think John Burr and I both started working in this neck of the woods when Jake was mayor, certainly told the current mayor that that's not the job that I did, that I cared for the city, and that's it. So, and then there's polls now that are saying residents aren't liking this idea, and we have talked about this many a Friday.
You've seen an extraordinary amount of pushback from regular folks in the community, John McGowan, city council members opposed to this idea of privatizing the utility. Mayor Curry responded the other day to his counterpart, former Mayor Jake Godbold's comments, and said he'd meet with him face to face. Some even questioned whether Jake Godbold actually wrote the letter that had been delivered to Mayor Curry.
Yeah, that would have been me. So,
yeah, that was you.
I knew you were coming to me on that. Yeah, I oopsed. It happens. But the signature did not look like his typical signature. And when you're in your mid 80s and you haven't heard from somebody in a while, there's a legit question. So I posed a question. I messed up. I wasn't accusing you of messing up.
No, but I'm
going to own up for that, because that's what you do when you make a mistake. You own up for it. So as far, you know, I think it was kind of bizarre that Godbold would come out in this fashion, in this way. It just seemed like a kind of a behind-the-scenes attack on the mayor that could have been just addressed with a phone call if he was legitimately concerned about, you know, the mayor's reputation.
You mean because the private letter was leaked to the press?
Correct.
Somebody leaked it.
It didn't, you know, it made it into the press. And anything you send to City Hall is public record if it's written down. A phone call, they're not recorded. So I could make a call to any of the council members. It's not recorded. There might be a record I called, but the content of that is not public record. As soon as you put it on paper or put it in email, that becomes public record. And AG sits up there and reads all the mail that the mayor gets and looks at all of it piece by piece. There are people that care about this. And I find it hard to believe that Mayor Godbold was not aware of that.
Okay, Claire Goforth. So now the pressure on the new CEO of JEA, the interim CEO, the board members, the mayor himself, over this matter, the scrutiny's gotten white hot. Full disclosure, your husband is an employee of the utility.
Yes,
your
indeed.
Thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I attended the board meeting when they named Aaron Zahn the interim CEO, and there was really no vetting of him. And I know he was in the room, and it can be awkward, but I mean, it felt like it was a done deal from the time they got up there and made their presentations. I think a lot of people were disappointed to not see the more experienced Melissa Dykes get that position, not only because of her gender, because it's rare in the utility world, but also because of her knowledge of JEA and how it operates. And then this idea that you're going to bring in a new guy and have him reorganize the executive branch of the utility and then hand over the reins to someone else if he's not selected for the ultimate job was a little confusing. I mean, I believe Councilman Newby was the one who said, okay, well, you're the interim CEO yesterday in the special committee meeting. Really, you just need to keep the ship going. You don't need to change direction with it.
John Burr, the Florida Times Union also published an article earlier this week, and Dan Scanlon, looking at Aaron Zahn's record in the private sector and issues he had with his company here in Florida. Mm-hmm. That didn't come up. It didn't seem to anyway in the vetting process for this. And so is that important as a business guy? Your thoughts about that?
It's important that apparently the business failed and that he left a tarnished reputation in Haines City, where the plant operated. It was a plant to make fertilizer out of human waste, and apparently he was pretty much told to leave town. That makes a difference to me. I mean, I think Zahn is quoted as saying that, well, you know, in business, failures happen, and that's true, but those aren't the people you run to run a billion-dollar enterprise generating electricity for your city. So I don't understand the vetting process. I don't understand the timeline. Mr. Zahn left the board on Friday, had some informal interviews with board members over the weekend at some undisclosed locations. And on Monday, he's voted in as the interim CEO. What is the urgency here? I don't understand it. Melissa Dykes was there. She was operating. She was coming to work, doing a great job, as she has for years. I don't understand the urgency in this appointment. And I think that's something that the board needs to explain to the public. This is our utility.
And for Melissa right now in this unspecified role that she has, I guess that really gives her, and this is sarcasm, a lot of good feeling about where she's going. Although, as our story stated this morning, she will be sort of the day-to-day operating chief operating officer. So maybe she is the one who will keep the JEA, listening to the city council committee yesterday, keep that JEA back on track, get the employees feeling more comfortable about what's happening. I've noticed there's been some complaints on Twitter from customers on JEA about things. So maybe they do need to focus on providing utilities and forget about the sale for a while because it was taking away from just daily operation.
John McGowan, your response, I guess, to critics of this whole process as it's played out, critics of the way Mr. Zahn was appointed see a conspiracy, whether or not one exists. They see an ally of the mayor being put into a key role to execute the mayor's agenda, which people like Jay Godbold and others are saying seems to involve a privatization eventually of this utility. Mr. Zahn is saying, no, my plan is not to privatize the utility. I think we need to put a pause on that and just focus on operating this utility to its highest level of effectiveness.
Well, and I agree, typically an interim person does not go through and do major changes. Your job is to keep the ship going in the right direction, if the ship is going in the right direction. And I think that's going to be part of the question is, do once we get past the JEA sale conversation, look at what's going on with JEA, is it operating at the level that it should? Can it be tweaked? And that might be some of the conversations that can there be some minor improvements, but you don't want to completely overhaul something in an interim position, because when the new full-time CEO comes in, then they're going to do it their way. And then you're going to look at a whole new overhaul. So typically an interim would not be a drastic redoing. I don't know what Mr. Zahn's plans are. And
that's the thing. And this happened so quickly. I think that's why this has been controversial. He'd been on the board less than 2 months, then resigned and was immediately appointed interim CEO.
Yeah, it's I agree. The optics of that definitely can raise eyebrows. But, you know, you're dealing with if this is an outside, like a regular business, I don't know that that would necessarily be abnormal. If you got somebody there that makes sense and you're like, wow, this guy could probably, you know, take the reins for a while. We're impressed with him. We've known him for a while. I don't think that would be extremely abnormal. What makes this so much more difficult is it's in the public eye, and it is something that is, you know, it's subject to sunshine laws and it's subject to public records and all these different things that makes this process it's so much more transparent, and we get so much more information, but we're still not getting all the information because not all of it's done in the sunshine, because it doesn't have to be in the sunshine. Once he left the board, then the meetings one-on-one no longer fall under that category. So now he's able to have the regular meetings like regular business would. So what we're getting is snapshots. We're getting little pieces of information, and that is not giving us a complete picture. So I don't fully know what's going on over there. But nobody really does, except for the board members.
I mean, we do know that we have a board that was appointed, for the vast majority of which, by the mayor. We have a former board member also selected by the mayor, who now has been chosen by the board to run JEA's interim CEO after a very brief vetting period, if there was, in fact, any vetting other than a few conversations. And we know that JEA, under the leadership of Paul McElroy, had raised its J.D. Power rankings. It had paid down a substantial portion of its debt. It had increased reliability. It had a better response time following the most recent hurricane in restoring power than private utilities around the state. And so to say that now, in retrospect, that somehow there's something wrong with JEA, I mean, certainly there's always improvement to be made. But Paul McElroy was, by most measures, doing an excellent job as CEO, and he was summarily shown the door from the looks of it on April 6th, and has only accessed that building one time since then, on April 8th, Sunday. So essentially, it looks as though he was pushed out. And now they made room for this Aaron Zahn person who has, I mean, at best, limited utility experience. Someone said to me that his utility experience is flipping on the light switch. And that is an opinion a lot of people hold, whether or not it's true.
You mean people inside that tower?
I couldn't speak to that, but I can speak to what I've heard among the people in the community.
All right, let's go to the calls from the community as our Friday Media Roundtable talks about the biggest headlines from the week. What are your thoughts about the latest? It's just been a blizzard of news about JEA. 549-2937. Dwayne on the north side. Dwayne, good morning.
Good morning. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
So my question is, who is behind the selling of JEA? I was a part of a community focus group, and they like paid us like $100 a piece, and they asked like leading questions to
what was this? Who put on this focus group, and what did they ask you?
Well, they were asking about the sale of JEA.
Who did the focus group, and how'd you get involved in it?
They didn't say who. They called me. They called me and asked me would I be a part of it. And when I went into it, I didn't know what it was going to be about. But once I got there, I found out that, you know, it was about the selling, the JA, and how the community felt about it. They said they were doing this throughout the city.
Who was they? So who was running it? Who were the people? Yeah. What was the entity running it?
They did.
Was there a name on the check?
Say, but
did you get paid to do it?
Yes.
What was the name of the company on the check?
You know, I guess I can look back and see that. But yeah, no, but they said they were doing this throughout the city. It was like 10 of us there, but it was like 15 people on the list to participate. And like I said, they were doing it throughout the city.
And what did the people in your focus group say?
Basically, the majority of the people said that, yeah, no, we shouldn't sell it. And, you know, why are we selling it and who's pushing it? Yeah.
Okay. And I'm going to put you back on hold, Dwayne. I want you to give our phone volunteer your number so we can try to track down who conducted that focus group. Dan Scanlon, your thoughts.
Well, obviously, did not City Council Member Danny Becton do that survey of residents regarding JEA?
Would he have paid people?
No, though? But that's the only survey that I'm aware of, and certainly that would have been fairly neutral, since I know the council member. He's my council member. The question is, who is doing a paid survey? And because that automatically, to me as a journalist, skews your results.
Yeah, and I mean, Curry's PAC has been spending thousands and thousands of dollars on various things for the past several months. It could be arguable it's coming from there. It could be coming from one of the interests that is supporting or opposing the sale as
maybe
well.
A lot of private utility companies have lobbied up John McGowan. They're getting into position in case this becomes an opportunity.
I don't think doing surveys or running polls or doing focus groups is abnormal. It comes across, you know, it could come across that way, but that's a normal thing. You go gather all the information and you want to know what the people think. And that's one thing that, I don't know if this was the Curry administration or not, but that's one thing the Curry administration has traditionally been very good at, is going out, getting all their facts before they made a proposal. And then that's way they knew, you know, whether it was going to be a good idea before they pushed hard on it. And so that's something
that they keep saying that they don't have a position. And well, then if they're doing this, I mean, we don't know, obviously, to be clear.
I wouldn't imagine they're running polls. I mean, they've got a poll on everything. That's what you do when you're a mayor of a major city, is you poll and you find out what the people are thinking and you find out, you know, what different ideas are. But as far as the privatization, you know, this is, I think we've got a very negative reaction to this. And there's this feeling that this is somehow some sort of secretive plan, but is this not part of the city ordinances that the mayor is required to look at privatization options of the different things that the city owns? That there's a city ordinance that's in place that requires the mayor to look at this and do studies over time, and if it makes sense to look at privatization. So
yeah, that's
simply
all
looking
well,
at
that's
it,
all well and good, John, but the procedures that are being employed here are look like a railroad job to a lot of people, and that's not good. You know, you've talked about the optics of this whole thing being bad. It's more than optics. The procedure here is it's a rush job, and, you know, for God's sakes, I've seen more kids running for student council put more effort into getting elected than Anthony Zahn had to put into being
Aaron Zahn. Let's go quickly to Catherine on the northwest side. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I was just calling to provide the name of the focus group that the previous caller referred to. That group was Data Targeting Inc. out of Gainesville, and the moderator, I was a member of the group that the previous caller referred to, and there was all one group of people in there.
Data Targeting, I think, has been doing some telephone polls around town recently, too.
They've also been getting paid thousands of dollars by one of Curry's PACs.
Okay.
In fact, when the caller previously was on the air, I wrote down the name Data Targeting to show to my colleague John Burr to my left.
All righty. Catherine, in this focus group, just what kind of questions were you asked, and what was the tone of the discussion?
Well, we were told that it was put together, we asked why were we selected and who was behind it. At first, there wasn't any mention of why, what the group was about, but after the first question, we knew it was about the selling of JEA, about JEA. We were told that it was a private group of investors, and they wanted to find out what were the thoughts about selling. They didn't come out and say selling of JEA, but we were told that there was a $90 million interest payment that was due from the $1.5 billion that it had incurred by the purchase of a nuclear power plant in Georgia that wasn't going anywhere, and that the possible sale of JEA would be between $3 to $6 billion. And at the end of all of that, we were asked various questions on that, what people thought, and at the end we were asked what we thought about Mayor Curry, and that was the end of that. And it lasted around about 45 minutes.
Okay, and were you like Dwayne? Were you paid what $100 to take part in this?
Yes.
Okay.
We did provide a stipend or $100 for participation.
Okay, and what did the focus group? What type of feedback did your group provide?
Well, virtually everyone was not. They recommended not the purchase of it because we are aware that usually the cost that they project on the sale of something is far less than what is actually obtained, and that there was a lot of questions that people had about it, things that have been raised from your panelists from previous discussions that you've had. And the one point that wasn't brought out, which you alluded to in one of your programs, Melissa, is that the water rights, that it would be substantially more from the sale of JEA with the water rights that comes with it. So it was all of the questions that have been previously raised, and there was a lot of distrust and about the citizens not wanting the sale, and that JEA was very responsive right now, and we didn't know what we would get, and that the cost of electricity and the responsiveness would be going up. So those were the issues.
Okay. All right. You know what, Catherine, I'm going to put you on hold, too, so we can get your full name and number. Stand by. The phone screener is going to take your information, so if we need to, we can follow up with you. Thanks for that call, Catherine, on the Northwest side. Okay, lots of information in that call.
That's great radio right there. Very interesting. I mean, it does seem if they started with a conversation about Plant Vogtle, that would be, I mean, if you were looking at it to determine whether or not it was a valid, you know, you'd say that that was probably designed to put people in a negative mind frame about JEA and then ask them a series of questions and hoping, you know, to get them to say that they would support the sale. I mean, and then if what she says is true, I have no reason to doubt her. The final question about their opinion of Mayor Curry is quite interesting as well.
All right. And okay, so that's just two callers to this show. It's we'll verify all this, but just to recap, we've received two calls from listeners saying they were paid to participate in a focus group by the firm Data Targeting, which is affiliated with the mayor's political action committee, to gauge public thoughts and sentiments about privatizing the utility. And so, as John McGowan pointed out, this is something that a large city mayor would probably do before teeing up such a controversial and major proposal for the future of this city. But let me just ask all of you as a follow-up, they're getting a lot of negative feedback from other city council members, from constituents, from these focus groups, that people are not on board with this idea, at least unscientifically. That's the sentiment.
So wouldn't you just shelf this idea for the time being if you're looking at this cold water?
Which is what the new CEO is saying.
And which is what the city council committee basically said, just to let it settle and work on the day-to-day business. I'd say shelve it. And then obviously they'll be working on a public relations campaign to make this a golden apple in 6 months or a year.
Isn't this just at some point going to come before the people of Jacksonville in a referendum?
It may ultimately.
I mean, isn't that really where we're heading for if this really gets
John McGowan
down the road?
Well, I was just going to say we're making a lot of assumptions based off of just finding out that a study had been conducted. We don't know what the intent was. We don't know what the results were. If you were to poll the five people at this table, I think it's going to be four people against it and one person going, well, let's see what happens.
Are you calling on the mayor to release the results?
No, I'm not calling on the mayor to release the results. When you do an internal poll that is associated with a PAC, that is that is their results. I'm not going to say that. If you want to do a poll, Folio can do a poll, and Folio can put a study in the field and do that. And that's, if you want something that's made public, somebody's got to pay for that. But, you know, if they're going through and they're looking at information, and that's how they're constantly polling. They're constantly polling, and they're constantly doing study groups, and they're going to look at each issue, and it's not, you're looking at it as, hey, well, they did a study group to figure out how to sell this. Well, maybe they did a study group in response to go, hey, what's the real reaction? Because you get these bubbles, right, and you get very loud people, and you get people on Twitter, and you get people that show up at the meetings, right, and you get the same 25 people that are showing up at the city council meetings, and that gives you just a small view of what the majority of the people are. That's a small view. That's their views. Those are the ones that care enough to show up to a meeting. What you got to find out is, what does the rest of the city do?
Which is why you do these types of focus groups in neighborhoods around town.
Well, yeah. And it's not only to find out what people think, but it's why they're thinking it and how a counter argument can be developed against the mm-hmm. thinking that you don't agree with. That's what a focus group's for.
Okay, Doran on the west side. Doran, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I was calling just to reflect on the whole idea of the viability of selling, or whether it's a good idea to sell the JEA utility. And one of the strongest arguments I've heard, and I listen all the time, is that we're at the peak moment, the highest value for JEA. However, I kind of started looking at the idea that came up on 1A last week, which is, if the city continues to own its own utility, then it can shift to renewable energy, and it's easier for a city-owned utility to make that transition without delay and without problems, and even convert the metering system if everything is owned by the city. But if it's privately owned, it's hard to make a transition. So I think our focus should be on, how do we start transitioning to renewable energies and renewable fuel, and then make that transition through JEA, and that way the value of JEA remains intact. That's my comment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And JEA does have a solar farm. JEA has shut down its coal plant. In fact, there might be some possibility of selling that huge Northside property and earning a little money for the utility, which would hopefully go back into the trucks, the employees, and the infrastructure.
They still have one coal plant.
Okay.
Regina in Mandarin. Hello, Regina.
Good morning. I just had a comment that this all smacks of good old boys network. I don't know if you have a comment, and your guests have a comment on that, of the interim appointed CEO. And also, has anyone heard Shad Khan's opinion? You know, he's a great leader.
Yes, and in fact, we let off the hour with that, Regina. Shad Khan at the State of the Franchise yesterday in Jacksonville.
Yes.
Which we're going to talk about in a moment, said that he believed privatizing the city-owned utility is a terrible idea. Khan saying, I've seen this all over the country. When you have a public entity like that getting privatized, it doesn't work well for residents. Then he went on to say, nobody's asked me, but I think it ought to stay the way it is. Nobody's asked him other than the reporters that were, you know, interviewing. Okay, but what about Regina's other comment that this whole process has smacked of the good old boys network in action? Certainly more women than men, I think, are pointing that out as they saw this spectacle of the CFO, Melissa Dykes, who oversees hundreds of employees and has decades of experience in the utility business, and made a pitch for the job, passed over for someone with really no experience in the utility business, but who's a white male. So what about that?
Yeah, I mean, she's the Hillary Clinton of JEA, losing a job to a less qualified man. But, you know, the good old boy network, does it run Jacksonville? Of course it does. I mean, it's been running Jacksonville forever. And we had one of them who suggested this, and then next thing you know, old Jeb's a millionaire, and here we are 5 months later. We're deep in this privatization conversation. Nobody really is taking credit for it yet. How did we get this far unless there's some sort of thing going on behind the scenes? Because it just seems mind-boggling that we would have expended all of this energy and money and time on something that nobody except maybe one or two people on the high levels of the city support.
You know what, though? I think those are all valid points, but I think that maybe what's been unexpected about all this is this extraordinary amount of pushback from the public and from city council. And perhaps those that teed all this up might not have anticipated.
But, you know,
that.
Let's not forget the rank and file who are out there who may, in fact, love the fact that Melissa Dykes is going to be the day-to-day operations person, will support her in what she does, and then conceivably her name comes up again when it's time to find the new CEO because they see what she does.
Okay. And as we continue with our Friday roundtable, folks still waiting on hold to talk about JEA, but we do need to move on and get into some other news and notes from the week. So give us a call right now as we move ahead at 549-2937. Now, also catching our eye this week, the Duval County School Board is looking at hiring more than 100 safety assistants. That's what they're calling them. They would be armed and equipped similar to school police officers, but have less training. This is something of a compromise safety plan for Duval County schools. The state allows schools to arm non-teaching staff, but Duval's school board, unions, and administrators say they're opposed to that, largely for safety reasons. This would be something of a compromise, one that other school districts might follow. John McGowan, your thoughts.
Well, the original, and I think this, well, the reason they came to this conclusion was because of money. They wanted to increase safety in schools. The way to do that was with armed officers. They cannot afford to put a police officer in every school. It just eats up too much of the budget. That was also what they looked at in the legislature and why the alternative was given to the schools. And that was one thing that was missed in this debate with the arming teachers. It wasn't required. It wasn't mandated. The Duval County School Board said, we don't want to do this, and they said, and they're not doing it. So they found another alternative that worked within that means, and that was hiring basically contract security guards is what they're really going to come down to. We can give them a fancy name, but it's a security guard because they're not sworn officers, and they'll be in the schools just to provide additional level of safety. And that's really all they can afford right now. And that's really what you're going to come up with, unless they find a way to start cutting costs at the school board and start shaving off some of the administrative costs that seem to be the real burden over there. This is what we're going to get, and this is going to be the best you're going to get.
Well, you know, this week I wrote about the fact, the bottom line is at Sandalwood High School this week, there was a gun and a knife found in a car outside after a student arrived late and a school board police officer found a loaded magazine, an ammo magazine on this kid, and then they went out and searched the car. And here's the other thing that surprised me. The campus has all locked gates and a security guard at the one main gate, so they were able to contain the car on campus so they could find it. That's the reality. School board police in high school, school board police in middle school, security guard in an elementary school, and a security guard, by whatever you say, is $12 to $12.75 an hour with not as much training as a police officer.
Right. These employees would get about 144 hours of training, including weapons and active shooter training. Law enforcement officers in Florida have more than 700 hours of training. If this plan is approved, JSO would conduct the training over the summer. And these folks would have brown uniforms rather than the dark blue ones the Duval School Resource Officers wear, but they'd have the same weapons and bullet-resistant vests. Their law enforcement authority would kick in if there is a threat on a school campus. That's why they're there. They would patrol the perimeters of schools. They would monitor locks, gates, doors, participate in school safety drills. And so, as John McGowan pointed out, even with this compromise, the district would have to kick in about $1 million this year, maybe more in future years, to pay for this plan.
I would want somebody, if we're going to go down this route, I would want somebody in schools who have actually more training than police. We're talking about a school which is full of kids. I would want somebody who is more than a $12.75 dollar an hour security guard with 100 hours of training. That's just me.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants kids to be safe, and I think the school board is trying to do the best with a bad situation with the funds that they've been given and the mandate that they've also been given. But, you know, John's right. when he says, you know, I'd rather see somebody with more training than a police officer rather than significantly less. Police officers receive 700 hours of this type of training. Meanwhile, these guards, who probably will be well-intentioned, will get 3 weeks of training, a little, you know, and then they're carrying a gun into a school. Now, if the kids were really convinced that this was going to increase their safety, why then are they walking out of school at 10 a.m. today on the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting, in part to protest the lack of meaningful gun control measures?
That's right. Today, April 20th, is National School Walkout Day. In Florida, there were school walkouts several weeks ago, but around the country, some students at some schools will be participating in the school walkouts, and or wearing orange, maybe, if they don't walk out, as a way to symbolically be part of it.
The scary part is that police officers sometimes freeze when they're in a serious situation with a gun. Even a deputy in the school in South Florida who did not go into the school when the active shooter was there on Valentine's Day. So can you expect anybody who only has 144 hours of training not to freeze or possibly want to get out of there if there's an active shooter? That's a scary thought.
Or well, to shoot a child.
Exactly.
Mistakenly.
Right.
You never know how you're going to react in that situation until you're in it. And having been in not an active shooter situation like that, but I have had to use a firearm before. So you just don't know how you're going to react. You just either you react and you move, or you freeze up. And there's no training that necessarily is going to override that core instinct. But I think the biggest thing is we're very focused on what would happen if there was an active shooter. But I think the reality of this is supposed to be just a deterrent. It's supposed to be a face. It's supposed to dissuade somebody from going in there. And there are definitely studies that show that if there is somebody that's armed and you know somebody's armed in an area, they are less likely to have a problem. Now, there are always outliers. Of course, what happened down in Central Florida in Parkland, there was an armed officer there and somebody still went in and did the shooting. But it makes somebody second guess and think again and question, am I going to go in there and do something stupid because if there's somebody there that's got a gun and could stop me? Right. But we're also dealing with people that have some other issues that aren't thinking clearly. So you got to look at it both sides. But I really believe this is just more of a deterrent.
With a rational...
All right, and let me just jump in and go to a few calls. Jason on the north side. Hi, Jason. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And can I just say, Melissa, thank you so much, because what I just listened to, you breaking the story, getting information on live radio, it's amazing, and it's amazing journalism. You're one of the reasons I listen to NPR, so I just have to say that.
Well, thank you for that.
Yay.
Oh, my God. I was almost about to cry. You're like my hero. Okay.
Well, we don't want you crying when you listen to us, but...
You can donate.
Yeah, be moved by your tears to donate. How about that? Thank you, Jason.
Well, absolutely. So my question is with addressing this issue of, you know, violence in schools, why not take the money and put it for after school or some kind of program for disenfranchised youth? Why not cut it off at the pass and actually deal with the issue, which is mental health, and take the money that you would put... Is that an option? I mean, how much money, this is the question, how much money are we going to spend on arming these people in our schools? So I'll take my answer.
Okay, Jason. Thank you so much. And our news partner, News for Jax, WJXT Channel 4, is reporting right now that there has been a shooting at a high school in Marion County. Forest High in Ocala, there is a suspect in custody there. Tragically, on this National School Walkout Day, it appears one person was injured this morning in a shooting at a school over in Ocala, not killed, but injured. Okay. So thanks to that call. And what about that caller's points?
I think it's, what, $22,000, $23,000 a year for each of these officers or security people?
Right. Yeah, about $21,000.
Right. Jimmy tweets the show, if Duval Schools wants guns in schools, those guns need to be carried by sworn officers with full training. That or no extra guns in private hands on school property. But as John McGowan pointed out, the budget isn't there for that.
Yeah, you go to an officer, you're up to $35 an hour is what it would normally. And that's not salary, but that's everything that comes with it. They usually figure about $35 an hour to put a sworn officer somewhere. So they're getting away with this at 12 and change plus whatever their overhead costs are. So you're probably going to come out around $15 an hour for a non-sworn officer versus a sworn officer. But it's to the caller's point about heading it off with a pass, you've got to do both ends of it. You've got to have some sort of fix now that provides some sense of safety. But that's then you get into Kids Hope Alliance, Shecksville Journey. These programs that have been around in the city trying to stem it on the front end here in Jacksonville, and it wasn't dealing necessarily with mass shootings, but it was dealing with crime issues and other things that came into play and trying to get in front of the youth early on. And I think that's going to be the angle that's going to be approached from.
But there's this idea, sorry, Melissa, more guns in schools will make kids safer. But in reality, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, the accidents that could happen, the mistakes that could happen. I mean, even in Broward County, I believe it was in February, an officer responding to a report of a school shooting, which had not occurred, it was just a loud sound, accidentally shot himself in the leg. That's a trained police officer. So, I mean, mistakes will happen. And then you have people making $12 to $12.75 an hour for 10 months out of the year who are going to have guns in schools. And what if they hear a cap gun and they think it's a real gun and they kill a first grader? I mean, you know, these are the kind of accidents that could happen. And I think when you put more guns in schools, you create more risks and more likelihood, a greater likelihood that things like that will occur.
And in just the past few weeks, we've had teachers, one as close as Georgia, who had a gun and it went off in the classroom. And again, thankfully, no one has been injured in that. But that brings up the other question. Some people are suggesting arming teachers, and teachers themselves have way too many things to deal with in a classroom and a school without having to also worry about packing a gun.
Okay. So are we saying that teachers aren't smart enough to be able to learn basic gun safety?
They are stressed beyond belief. Trust me, I'm married to one.
It's basic gun safety. There's the three rules of gun safety, and you know that we ingrain to people as they're going through just basic concealed weapons training.
But overwhelmingly, the teachers are saying they don't want any part of that.
Well, and that's fine. Yeah. But what we're saying, the teacher's saying we don't want to do it. That was the option that was given to them. But it seems there's this attack that we love teachers. Teachers are the best thing ever. They give so much to the community. Yeah, but they're not smart enough to figure out how to safely handle a gun is how that conversation keeps coming across. And I don't understand that. And then we say this, oh, well, this guy's just making $12.75 an hour. Well, are we judging people based off their income level?
I disagree with the comment that they're not smart enough. I think they have way too much on their plate right now. We've seen nationwide teachers striking because they're not getting enough pay and having to pull stuff out of their own pocket to pay for school supplies. To throw a gun and training on top of that when a 10-month-a-year school teacher is working 12 months a year to prepare, I think is been shown to be a little too much.
Okay, guys. And I appreciate all points of view. What a wonderful, robust discussion we're having this morning on this topic, which is awesome. And we're getting so many tweets right now from people saying they are really enjoying this show. So all four of you are to be credited for that. But I do need to make one more note. Big changes coming for the Jaguars and TIAA Bankfield this week. The two-tone helmets are gone and the teal uniforms are back, baby. Oh, also, yeah. The Jaguars released new renderings this week for their proposed entertainment zone in Lot J and the Shipyards parcels around the stadium. Everybody, what did you think of the new uniforms?
The NFL's
first ever dog park at Everbank Field. Mm-hmm. Panel?
First swimming pools, now a dog park?
Well, you know, they could play in black pajamas for all I care. They just have to win games, and that's what fans care about. I mean, I'm pretty if you're going to talk about, you know, the plans for the Metro Park and the riverfront development, I'm pretty jazzed about that. That looks terrific.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. Man, yeah. 9-year season ticket holder. I'm all for it.
I just hope they don't find stuff that they can't handle in the old oil and grease and everything else that's under that property from the shipyards and whatever.
Well, that no question. That's a big problem. But, you know, these types of things have been dealt with in other communities very successfully, and they've got a good developer here. Shad Khan, I agree with him on JEA. I was sitting on the fence of JEA for a while, but now I'm looking at this process. I'm saying, boy, what a botched job. I agree with him there, and I agree with him on Metro Park. I say, let's go.
All right. John McGowan, John Burr, Dan Scanlon, and Claire Goforth, what a great discussion. Thanks to all four of you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Melissa.
A quick break, and in a moment, living legend Johnny Mathis. That's next.
The news is usually about what's happening on the ground, but not always. Is your airplane physically on fire?
No, it's not on fire, but part of it's missing.
Comey's confession, a coffee shop confrontation, a courageous crash landing, and Carl Castle. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, interviews with Milos Forman and Harry Anderson, who both died within the past week. Forman was an Academy Award-winning director, known for such films as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and Ragtime. Anderson was a magician and actor who was nominated for an Emmy for his portrayal of Judge Harry Stone on the NBC sitcom Night Court. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatto, and I just got a brand new backyard telescope, and I'm looking for advice on what to look for. This week on Science Friday, the resident astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, Dean Regas, is here to help out. Dean joins us from the country's oldest observatory with tips on viewing the sights of the summer skies on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
This week, we learned of the CIA director's visit to North Korea.
We have had direct talks at very high levels.
Tension between the White House and the UN ambassador.
She said, quote, "With all due respect, I don't get confused."
And a death.
Former First Lady Barbara Bush has died. She was 92 years old.
Reviewing the week in politics this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that.
Well, he is a living legend with more than 60 years in the music business. Singer-songwriter Johnny Mathis has sold millions of albums. He's recorded nearly 80 of them since first topping the charts back in the 50s with hits like this one, Chances Are. A sublime vocalist known as the voice of romance and one of the most enduring performers in musical history, Mathis has three songs that have been inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. His latest album, Johnny Mathis Sings the Great New American Songbook, features him singing current hits from artists like Adele, Pharrell, and even Bruno Mars. Johnny Mathis plays the Florida Theater next Thursday night, April 26th. I spoke with him about his incredible career in music. Johnny Mathis, a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for asking me.
It is really exciting to talk to you. You know, I've told a number of people I was going to be interviewing you, and people of all ages were really excited to hear that you were going to be on the show.
They probably said, "Is he still alive?"
No, they really didn't. But you know, as I was looking at your bio, it's just incredible. You are marking your 62nd anniversary as a recording artist. Just an amazing career in music. Tell me about this new album, which is so exciting. You've done a new album of contemporary songs. Johnny Mathis Sings the Great New American Songbook. What inspired this album?
Well, from the time I started singing, I always kind of was obligated along with the single records that I was making was to record music that was popular of the day. And I've continued that bit of my career. And this is the latest one. There's some really good songs on here, and I've gotten now a little different kind of accompaniment as far as the orchestras are concerned. There's a lot going on behind me musically, and it's fun and very interesting, and it holds the attention. I think that was the idea, because kids nowadays, or people in general, I guess, have so much going on in their daily life, as far as listening is concerned, that you need something pretty spectacular to catch their attention.
Sure. Yeah, well, this will definitely do it. But you've been doing this for decades. Of course, your first big hit, or one of your first big hits, Chances Are, I didn't realize this, it's one of three songs in the Grammy Hall of Fame. That's pretty. Wow. That's something to hang your hat on, isn't it?
It sure is. My dad would be so happy. My dad was my best pal. He and my mom had seven kids, and yet he was the one who inspired me to sing. He was a singer himself, but of course he didn't get an opportunity to sing for the general public because he had seven children. But he gave me so much attention as a youngster, and from the time I was a little baby, I remember listening to him sing, and over the years, I think I've recorded all of the songs that I've heard him sing.
Wow. So 60 years in the business, you've never stopped singing or recording since you got started in 1956. I think your voice really has a timeless quality, and it's why you've enjoyed this longevity.
I've never forget when my dad told me, said, "Son, we're going to go out and find a voice teacher." I said, "Pop, I don't need a teacher. I listen to you sing. I sing like you do." He says, No. He says, he explained to me from the time I was about 12 years old how important it was to have a teacher just so that you could maintain whatever vocal qualities that you had. And he was absolutely right on.
Now, for this new album, you chose some songs that have been made so popular by young artists like Hello by Adele, Happy by Pharrell, Bruno Mars, Just the Way You Are. What went into your choices for the songs you chose to interpret? How'd you pick the songs?
Actually, I have a lot of help from people of that age, and also some of the people from the record company. From the time I was a little kid, but from the time I started making albums, I always sang the songs of the day. We had specialty albums along the way that I've recorded over the years, songs in Spanish or in French or religious songs. But we always included the songs that were popular at the time, and we've maintained that. And these songs are really wonderful, and the orchestrations now are absolutely mind-boggling. There's so much going on to keep the attention of the listener, and I'm really excited about these new songs. I have help as far as people telling me, try this, try that, and so far, so good.
So far, so good. Yeah, I'll say so. I hope I can emulate this type of longevity. It's just incredible to see generation after generation enjoying your performances. So it's going to be great to see you come to Jacksonville and perform here. We're excited to host you in town. And thank you so much for giving me a few minutes of your time on the radio this morning. Really exciting to talk to you.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'll be there with all of my friends who helped me put on these performances, and mostly their musicians that have been with me for a very long time. So, Jacksonville, here we come.
Here he comes, Johnny Mathis. And that's our show. Could we play a little bit more of Johnny Mathis? I guess not. He's singing Bruno Mars' Just the Way You Are. Take a listen. Get tickets to see his show next week. He's a living legend. This man is 82 years old. Take a listen.
And when you smile, the whole